Hello and welcome to Pitchside with Toby Reynolds, a Sports Gazette podcast, where each episode we take a deep dive into a new sporting topic with a new guest. I am your host Toby, and this week I'll be joined by Jared Kimber to discuss cricket analytics and the top 50 test batters of all time. Jared is a cricket writer, creator, commentator and analyst, and the founder of the Good Areas and 99.94 Network. Throughout this episode, we look at the importance of analytics, Bazball's underlying numbers, how he created the list of top 50 test batters, as well as how the Fab Four rank on the list. I'm now joined by Jared. How are you, mate?
Not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to get into the podcast. It's going to be quite an analysis-based podcast, I think, and talk a little bit later about maybe the top 50 test batters and your list that you're trying to create around all that. But let's jump right in, I guess, with you're probably most well-known for your deep dives and analysis into cricket, particularly now with your YouTube channel and podcast as well. How important do you think that skill is within cricket, and how important is the analysis and data side behind it all?
I think for a very long time, cricket was kind of left behind by the fact that compared to most sports, cricket writers are a long distance away from the actual sport. And so if you go back and you read old cricket writing, it really does have an issue with really telling us what was happening on the field. And so cricket writing then becomes this sort of more romantic narrative-based system, which is fine. But it does, I think, then it didn't really update with the times. And so I suppose the birth of Stats Guru is a hugely important thing when Crick Info start, when Travis invents that for Crick Info. That's a hugely important change in cricket culture, I think. And then on top of that, obviously Moneyball and then Crick Fizz and Hawkeye and all those different things that come in. It needed to be updated. You go through the old history books and there's some nice tales and everything, but quite often you have to kind of scrape the data on how the game was played. And that isn't the case with a lot of other sports. And I do think the distance, as I said before, played a big part in that. And then it sort of became the way that you did it. You wrote Neville Carter style articles, whereas actually maybe the best cricket writing is focusing on legitimately what is happening in the game. And that seemed to be overlooked a little bit. So data allows us to do that.
Have you always been interested in that side of the game?
Data?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't exist. So, no, not really. I mean, I always looked at cricket very differently than other people, like closer than other people, and obviously had a very different writing style than a lot of the other professionals around. But no, it just wasn't a thing that we had. From the moment a Stats Guru existed, I spent a lot of time on there and worked that out very early. But that was very, very basic compared to the sort of stuff that I do now. But, you know, if I put something out online, I wanted to make sure it was as close to the truth as I could get as possible. So whether that would be stats or data or any kind of information of, you know, on a player, that's really what I've always trying to do. And, you know, data has just made that a lot easier.
Mm. And then sort of following on from that, you mentioned about some of the stories right now and obviously the YouTube and the podcasts. How'd you come up with sort of some of these ideas? Do you start by looking at the stats and the data, and then coming to conclusions from there, or is it more of a hunch you have and the data almost reinforces that, or a bit of both?
Yeah, there's no real one way. I know there are probably other people that probably start with spreadsheets and other people who start with video. I'm kind of immersed in cricket. I'm working in it all the time, doing many different jobs and talking to people in cricket and, you know, getting messages from people in cricket. And, it could be anything. It could be a conversation. It could be a half thought I had one day. It could just be some footage that I'm looking at that does it. Or, you know, occasionally it'd be an outlier. There's no one way for me. I don't really think about it that way. For me, it's about storytelling, right? Is there a story here? And that might be a story that you see on a spreadsheet, or it might be a story that you see in front of you unfolding with your eyes. So it doesn't really matter to me which way it starts. It's just that once I get that nugget, I'm probably just going to pick at it a lot further than like a normal person would.
How long do some of these sort of video concepts and article ideas take to form?
I've spent years writing articles before. That's not all that. I've got a piece at the moment that I think I've been working on for 2 years, and who knows when it will ever come out, if it will ever come out, if we're being honest. And there are other articles that probably look really, really complex to other people that might have taken me an hour and a half to write. I'm a very quick actual writer, so the typing element of it. Whereas I think that's where a lot of people struggle. It's more the research. I just keep going from layer to layer of research at times. But yeah, there's if I'm doing something that's probably around 3 or 4,000 words, that should take me, a good week and a half, to be able to do. But I've probably done that level of article in a day and a half before. And as I said, I've got this other thing that I've been working on for a couple of years, and I've done that quite regularly. I think I did a huge piece about wiki-keeping a few years ago, and that probably took me a good couple of years to get all the information that I wanted out there. So again, I don't have a great answer for that. It depends on the story and how easy it is to kind of construct or what period it is. Sometimes you come up with a great idea, but you're in the middle of a test series and you can't just stop and go off so I probably have at any one time between, I don't know, 50 and 100 different unwritten articles or half-written articles or podcast ideas, video ideas, whatever they may be. Sometimes it's all the same, and when I get to them, I get to them. So whether that means I'm technically working on them, I don't know, but they're there and there's notes.
There are also lots of ways of different ways that people like to measure cricketers, obviously. And I mean, loads of different stats have been created over the last few years. I mean, obviously averages and have been around for, well, since the start of cricket, really. But are there any stats that you think are really overvalued or undervalued and that maybe people either look too much into or don't really pay attention to?
I think averages in first class cricket and test cricket over a certain period of time probably stand up, give you a good idea of a player's worth. But not factoring in what all the other players did in the same era or in the same games kind of takes away the context of that, because cricket is such a pitch dependent sport, and also trend dependent, which is more the case for any sport. So I think if you're looking at a player's overall worth, especially over a 10 or 15 year career, you have to look at, was this a high scoring period or a low scoring period? The pitches that they played on, were they easy to bat on or were they hard to bat on? We can work all that out. It's not all that hard. We can check what the other batters did, right? We have all that information available to us. So I think having a look at the sort of, a match ratio or an era ratio for batters is probably a great way of doing it. But there's heaps of other, I think in T20 cricket and one day cricket specifically, those two formats, everything is context based. So if I was to bowl the first over of the game, the average economy in the first over a game is 5.5 runs, right? If I bowl the sixth over of the game, it's 8.3 runs, right? So if I bowl the first over and you bowl the sixth over and my over goes for six and your over goes for seven, you've actually done better than I've done, right? But it doesn't look that way. So strike rate, which and economy, which we go on and on about, is actually dependent on which part of the game that you're playing it. And so I think there's lots of things like that that people don't quite understand. And it's very easy for someone who comes in for the last five overs of a T20 game to have a high strike rate because they've been told to go out there and whack it. The person who comes in for the eighth over is not coming in that same situation. So I think there's a lot of context in those sorts of things. And you're trying to work out, how those things actually work. And I think with players as well, with batters and with bowlers a little bit, we look at total average, but we don't actually look at what they're good at. So you can have an average of 25 as a bowler, but you might be averaging 40 against right-handers, and 16 against left-handers, right? Like we need to actually dive into what it is that you do well on a cricket field. And I think that's probably where cricket has been left behind. There's a really funny thing about cricket and data, which is in baseball, they had the shift. And it took them, I think they had the shift in the 1950s. Then they didn't like it and they got rid of it. Then it came back and it got so big that baseball fans complained. And basically, the shift has been banned in baseball. The reason that they didn't know to shift the fielders earlier is because no one was mapping where anyone was hitting the ball. We've been doing that in cricket since the 1700s, right? But we never thought to map where the fielders were. So we have all these lines that tell you where a batter's hit it, and essentially we've been mapping for years where there's no fielder, right? And it's little things like that that we can just do a lot better.
Yeah, I guess baseball, on the other hand, know exactly where the fielders were, but then didn't know where the balls were.
Exactly. So between the two sports, they were perfect.
Yeah.
They just never got together.
No, well, maybe they might be able to find a way of somehow going back in time, but that might be a few more years. Another sort of big growth within the game has been matchups as well over the last few years. Do you think that there's been a lot of talk by, I mean, T20 in particular sort of seems to focus on matchups as well, sort of offies against left-handed batters are such a big one, particularly using part-timers for something like that. Do you think that there's a lot of value within that, first of all, and then also within the test side of the game, do you think there might be a growth as there has been over the few years, or is it not as valuable as T20 perhaps?
Test cricket is harder because you generally only have four bowlers. And so maybe you have a fifth bowler who's okay if you're really lucky. It's very rare to have five bowlers who are all of test quality available to you in one side at any stage. Generally, most moves that are made in test matches are because someone is tired and they need to be replaced. And so there's a lot of talk about how tactical geniuses captains can be. And you're just like, yeah, I think he just took that guy off because he's tired. T20 cricket is very different because you're trying to hit harder. So the tactic, the matchup makes more sense because you can't just block out your matchup. You have to try and score against it. So you do have a weakness against that player. But matchups are far more complicated than I think fans understand, and that cricket has understood for a long time as well. You know, boundary size plays a part. Wind plays a part. If you've got a terrible off spinner going up against a left-hander who's not terrible against off spin, he's probably still going to smash him. So it plays a part, but you know, to be able to do it algorithmically, and I've seen teams try and do this before, it doesn't quite work the way that they think it does. And it's because you can never feed enough information into the algorithm on a moment by moment basis. So for instance, a cricket ball during the course of a game will age and will react differently off the surface. So even if you have a lot of information to put into your matchup algorithm, it might be that at a certain point that, you know, you might have a batter who's not particularly good against left arm pace. And so you bring the left arm pacer back on. But at that point, you'd be better off bowling a spinner because the ball has got a little bit older. Stuff like that, you might not always be able to factor into any, you know, how the pitch is playing, how, you know, the conditions and everything else. So matchups are important, but knowing why they're important and how they're important and looking for all the details is always a better way of doing it. And unfortunately, I think matchups get a bad name in part because a lot of teams just don't do them correctly. And they try and do it algorithmically, whereas actually you need to be smarter within that. Know what good matchups are is a really important thing, but also the ability to be able to go away from them when the conditions or when the match situation doesn't favour it.
On a more sort of, you know, recent basis, England have been absolutely, well, not absolutely battered, but have lost comfortably in the end to India quite recently. And I saw a video you put out over the last couple of days about the stocks of all the players within it, which is quite a fun way about going about it in a little series review. When you were sort of doing all your research for that, were there any sort of underlying numbers that really stood out as to the major reasons why England failed in India?
They're not very good. I mean, you know, England have gone through the biggest revolution of Test cricket that we've probably ever seen a team try and do. Maybe Sri Lanka in the mid-90s would be up there as well. But I'd probably say England went through a bigger revolution than any other team that we've seen before. And they did that because they were terrible. And what they were trying to do is come up with a disruptive way of playing against teams. And for a little while it worked until teams started to work out that England was actually, what they were doing was very smart, but very one-dimensional. And if you look at what India did in this series, they were completely put off by it for about a test and a half. And then they went, actually, we just need to wait and this team's going to punch itself out, right? If we react to what they are doing, that's exactly what they want, right? We'll put a couple of extra fielders out on the boundary. That's fine. They want to hit the ball over the boundary, over those fielders. That's okay. But we believe we have the quality to be able to do that. So I think it was basically, that was the difference between them. And if you look early on, India was panicking a little bit and they didn't know what to do. And then when they went back and they became a little bit more sensible with what they were doing, England didn't catch up. So, you know, it's, I think The baseball revolution that England have been on is maybe one of the most important things we've seen ever in cricket. But if you, it's a bit like a basketball team who only shoots three pointers, right? It's like, okay, so we just don't worry about guarding the paint or the mid-range anymore. We can deal with that, right? Like, you need to be able to score in three areas in basketball, even if the three-pointer is your most lucrative shot. They can defend that, right? And it's a bit the same with baseball. If you're going to play a shot at every single ball, even when they put the fielders out on the boundary, and you have good bowlers, you'll think to yourself, well, eventually they're just going to hole out. They're just going to make a mistake, right? And all we need to do when we bat is make sure that we don't do it. So I think the actual talent differential between those two teams was a big part of it.
You mentioned that you thought it was a massively important development, baseball in particular. There have been like attacking teams and attacking players before. Why specifically this? Just because it's so different to anything else in the past?
We've not, I mean, we've not really had attacking teams before when it comes to batting. I think Australia was the fastest scoring batting team compared to their era, and they were marginally quicker than the other teams in their era. They were still scoring it under 4 runs and over. England was scoring it 6 and 7 runs and over, right? So we haven't really had this before. We've had attacking players before, but those are usually been players who have backed their individual skills, and that's the way that they are best at scoring. So Matt Prior played in the era before this, or a couple of eras before this, for England, and he's got top 20 strike rate of all time. But it's because Matt Prior thought technically he wasn't as sound as other players, and he thought to himself, I've got about 50 to 70 balls here. And in those 50 and 70 balls, I need to score as many runs as possible, or they'll get me, right? That's very different than an entire team coming at it from that angle. And then taking the skills from the other formats, the white ball formats, the limited overs formats, and repurposing them in a test match system is very, very different. Running down the wicket, England run down the wicket when they bat in test matches. Like, teams have never done things like that before, right? And so it's a very, very different way. And, you know, even in the West Indies and Australia, so Australia decided to bat faster in the late 90s because they kept getting draws. They were sick and tired of dominating games that they couldn't finish. But they weren't batting recklessly. They were just trying to bat a little bit quicker, backing their bowlers to be able to get the wickets at the other end, and so that they would get more results. The West Indies kept playing their spinners, and their spinners weren't as good. And so they went to fast bowlers, but they batted more or less the same that they had batted before. They just changed their bowlers. England has changed almost every part of their cricket, to their selections, to the coaching, to the analysis, to the strategy. You could argue the fitness. They're probably not as fit as they used to be on purpose, because they spend more time relaxing, because they want more energy for when they're playing. All these different things that they're doing, is that is a, you know, from 0 to 10 revolution, and we've never seen anything like that before.
And then how do you think they might go in the future? Obviously, they've got a somewhat easy summer as it goes, and then the winter coming up is what the winter they had last winter. But then they have India at home and Australia away in sort of a year and a half's time. How important do you think that will be for baseball, sort of defining the, well, defining baseball?
I think Brendan McCullum has already probably said the smartest thing that he said in a long time when he came out after the test, and he was basically saying, we need to use the best of this strategy and be smarter about how we use it. And I think that's what I've probably been one of the biggest defenders of baseball. I think there's been a lot of people in the English press have been waiting for it to fail. And I've always said it will probably fail. But I also said that there's a lot of things that they're doing right. And so if you focus in on the things you're doing right, and you also keep an open mind, so you go, we don't have to do this because everyone's done this before, that actually gives you the best way. The problem with what they were doing before was it was so didactic and so Kool-Aid. It was literally, oh, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we fail 10 times in a row, because you know, the 11th time will be awesome. And I was like, well, it does matter. I mean, clearly it matters. Right? Like, that's professional sport. There are certain things that you can do and that you can't do. And it's great to be disruptors, but you have to be quite a little bit smarter than that. And, you know, you look at what England is now saying, and they're going, that's what we want to be. We want to get to that level. They probably lost the Ashes by being arrogant. And they probably lost well, they drew a series in New Zealand they should have won, again, by being a little bit arrogant. They don't need to be arrogant, right? They just need to be, they're using this really smart strategy that other teams aren't really set up to use in the same way. They can continue to evolve that and move it forward. And if that's the case, they're still probably not going to be as good a team as Australia or India when they play them in a couple of years. But if they don't make the mistakes that sabotage themselves, that means the other teams are going to have to come up with theories to beat them. And we saw when they played a really good New Zealand team, it's not easy.
Could you not argue with the arrogance sort of point there that every kind of professional athlete needs that little bit of arrogance and sort of belief within themselves, and particularly when they're trying to be so aggressive and so out there, that actually without that arrogance after two test matches or after their first test match at Lord's where it didn't quite go as planned, they might have struggled a lot more and they might not have actually stuck with it and they could have almost fallen back into the way they were with their one win in 17.
But they already knew it was working as a theory. Why did they have to be reckless with the theory that was already working? Why do you have to declare at Edgbaston when you could make another 50 runs, put yourself in a position to really put pressure on Australia in that test match, right? So you say that all professional athletes need arrogance. I think that's a fair statement, right? But boxers don't lead with their right hand every single time. Right. Even if they think they have the fastest right hand in the world, they still use their jab first. Right. That doesn't mean there haven't been situations when boxers haven't won fights using their right hand. England were trying to use their right hand and then tell everyone else that even when the right hand wasn't working, that everyone else was idiots and that they knew what they were doing. Right. There are sometimes you need to jab. Right. That's what the jab is there for. The whole idea is it's the shorter punch. You're not going to put the same amount of impact on the boxer when you hit them. But you can get them into the situation to use your stronger hand. If you're just using your stronger hand, if you're just shooting everything from mid-court in a basketball game, right? Or if you're just trying to, if you're just trying to hit hole in ones every time in golf or whatever it may be, at a certain point you're going to fail. It doesn't matter how arrogant you are. The laws of physics, right? Eventually still play a part in it. So I've got no problem with them having belief. There's a difference between having belief and also having the critical ability to go, do you know what? We got that wrong. Right? Edgbaston would have been a perfect example of them to go back at the end of that test and go, do you know what? We probably got that wrong, but it came from a good position. This is why we got that wrong. That's what smart people do, right? If you just say, we got it wrong, but fuck all you guys don't know what you talk about. We're just going to keep doing it. Wait a minute, you just made a mistake. Right? And I think that's where they got to. If you're not being self-critical in this world, doesn't matter how arrogant or talented you are, you're probably going to make an ass of yourself. And if you don't understand what I'm saying there, have a look at Elon Musk's last 5 years, right? That is someone who doesn't have people, right, telling him this doesn't make, why do you don't need to spend millions to make this into X. X isn't worth any more than Twitter is. Why are you doing this? You're just doing it because you like the letter X. That doesn't make any sense, right? That's not going to improve this. It's actually devaluing the thing that you bought, right? And he can't be self-critical. And so you go through Elon Musk's career and you see all these wild swings, right? He might end up being in 20 years still an incredibly successful person because he clearly has really good instincts in many different ways. Would he be slightly better if he was also had that ability to just go, this is what works for me and this is what doesn't work for me? This whole obsession with the letter X, I don't need to worry about this. This whole thing of trying, of trying to make a free speech platform doesn't actually, it makes me look silly when I ban people for saying things that are negative. This little things, there's no, I came through sports writing when there were still sub editors and editors, right? At that stage, you could kind of write shit and someone would go, no, we can't put that up. This is why we can't put it up. You've got to make this better, whatever it may be. A couple of years later, I'm in a situation where I can publish anything I want at any stage, right? That means the buck completely stops with me. Now, I am a completely different kind of writer who probably does go out on limbs and does say things that other people won't say, right? But if I'm not self-critical in myself, going, I got that one wrong. This isn't a good article. I shouldn't have put that up. How will I get any better? Right? The arrogance and the confidence and the skill, put shows to one side. This is what the world is, right? England knew they made mistakes. If you're not going to try and grow and get better from them, what is the point?
Do you think within the changing room they are having these kind of conversations, sort of maybe going from it? Because I feel like McCullum at times is hinting that they are sort of vaguely understanding, they know where they're going wrong, and they sort of perhaps are talking about it, or and that the outside world and to the media, they want to sort of show the sort of so-called strength that they have, that they are so focused in one direction.
I think McCullum said after this test match that they're going to relook at the sort of statements they make to the media, which would suggest to me that the same sorts of things are happening in the change room, and that, what they really need to do is just look at what works and what is not working and start again. They've got a system that is probably going to smash up a lot of average cricket teams and has already upset the Australian and the New Zealand team. So that's two of the best teams. And beat India in India and had India frazzled for a little while. I think they would be absolutely stupid if at this stage they didn't just have a bunch of roundtable discussions with key people around cricket and just be like, great, we've started this. How do we make it even better? Right. And I don't think that's what they were doing. I think their public statements were pretty accurate of how they thought. They thought everyone else was an idiot and they were onto something great. And there were many people like myself looking at the numbers going, but they don't make any runs in the first innings. So how's this going to work? Or the other big thing is, if you bat really fast in test cricket, that means your bowlers never get any rest, right? Over a long series, that's going to cause an issue for your bowlers. So little things like that, I do think were problems with that. But, you know, it's fine. It's okay. As I said before, they were a flawed team and they've got a lot out of themselves. But it would be stupid to just be like, McCullum and Stokes do no wrong, because we've seen them do wrong things, right? And McCullum and Stokes, I think it's great that it's McCullum who's come out and said this, because McCullum has been absolutely glorified in English cricket to a certain point of which, you know, he could say, what if we played cricket naked? And I honestly think the England team would go out naked, right? Like, it's got so ridiculous. And he is a really smart person, but also he's got his own issues and biases, and the same as everyone else. Like, sometimes you just need to sit down and work out what it is that you are doing. And I don't think they've been doing that enough. You know, Zach Crawley fails and they give him a cigar and they tell him it's fine, next match you'll get it back. That's great. Can we teach him to play spin better, right? Because that's also a part of it. Pumping him up is absolutely brilliant. But if he keeps going out the same way in every test match because he's got a strong bottom hand and he has a problem driving, you can give him as many cigars as you want. Like, sometimes you have to look at both sides of things, right? And it's not about being negative. It's going, Zach, you're doing this great. We want you to keep doing all this. Is there a way we can also help you with this issue so we can make you slightly more complete? So they don't have to give him frigging cigars and tell him how great he is. He'll just be that player.
Now, I teased it a little bit earlier in the podcast, but over the sort of last year or so, you've been trying to work out the top 50 test batters throughout, well, the whole history, is it? Or sort of since, all of history. I guess, the first place to start is how have you been trying to measure it, and what factors have you been taking into account?
Yeah, I mean, we started with basic things like, I think we've got a minimum of 2,000 runs. There's a few players that we might put on the list that don't have 2,000 runs, but as a general rule, if you haven't scored 2,000 runs, you know, we don't have that, the evidence to be able to look up your career. We're looking at players home and away. We look a lot at players against the best teams in their era. You know, so if you look at someone like Kane Williamson, he's a fantastic player. But if you look at him compared to the best players of his era, he has to drop down quite a few spots because he doesn't. I think the only good bowling attack that he regularly has dominated in his career has been South Africa, and it's been South Africa when he's played at home. So instantly we could see that. Then you've got other things as well, like 1970s, 80s and 90s was quite tough for batters. 2000 to 2016 was great. If you're a really good batter and you made your debut around the year 2000 and you retired before 2017, you're probably going to have 3 or 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 extra runs on your average at times, just because it was such a great era for batters. Whereas if you played before World War II, before World War I, if you averaged 40, you were probably pretty fantastic. So we're looking at the context. We're looking at players versus pace versus spin. You know, are there certain players? I think it's Mihailo J. Wardner who makes something like 70% of his runs in Asia, right? Or actually, I think it might be more than that. 75% of his runs in Asia. And then, so if we look at his record outside of Asia, does he hold up against other players who were great in Asia and outside of Asia, right? Doesn't mean Mihailo's not a great player. We're nitpicking because every player on our list is absolutely fantastic. Then we're looking, you've got a player like Matt Hayden, who I find really, really interesting, who Matt Hayden really only had 7 great years, right? He struggled at the start of his career, and it took him a long time to get into that Australian team. And then he had 7 of the most incredible years ever. How does that compare to, I don't know, let's come up with, I'm just looking at my list. How does that compare to Hashim Amla? Actually, Hashim Amla is a terrible example there. how does that compare to Gary Kirsten, who obviously was the same kind of impactful player as Matt Hayden, but did it for 12 or 15 years over a couple of different eras, right? You know, so that's what we're looking at. And, you know, longevity is a really important thing. But the interesting thing in Test cricket, of course, is that players played different amount of matches in the old days than they do now. So I think I think Jack Hobbs played for a couple more years than Tendulkar did. I think that's right. I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head. Let's have a look. Years. Yeah, he played for a couple of extra years than Tendulkar did, but he played a fraction of the tests, right? So we have gone away from the amount of tests that you've played, and we're looking at the actual years that you've played, right? And then so you look at players like Tendulkar and Hobbs. You could make the argument that perhaps Lara or Callis or Wally Hammond and some of these other players were better players at their peak than Tendulkar and Hobbs. But if you're selecting a cricket team and you know in 1987 that you have a guy who can bat at number 4, who's still going to be able to bat at number 4 in 2010, right? That's a big difference between Matt Hayden, who had a 7-year peak, right? And so there are other things that we look at as well, which is how many great years did someone have? And how many average years, not average is the wrong way of putting it, but we kind of look at good years and great years. So how many years did you average over 40 in Test cricket? And how many years did you average over 50 in Test cricket? And so you have players who have ridiculous records, but it's because in a 3-year period, they make a mountain of runs. But the rest of their career, they don't have that much of an impact, right? And then you have other players who actually manage to have great years consistently over a long period of time, but they're marginal great years. So, you know, you're looking at, you know, all of those sorts of things. And then you've got percentage of runs scored and the fact that it's harder to be an opening batter than it is anywhere else. So I think our original metric was 2,000 runs at a 45 average. That was where we started to look. And then we realized there were no openers. All the openers average between 42 and 45. So we're like, okay, so we can now work out a percentage of how to boost the openers up so that we can understand that. Because it should be a third of this list should be openers because we're talking about top 6 players, right? So if our list doesn't have roughly a third openers, it means we've probably done something wrong. Then we've looked at, there's a big difference between opening and every other position. But if you're a number 3 and you're a number 6, number 6 is the armchair position, right? So we have to, you know, factor in that it's a much easier to bat at number 6 than in anyone else. We've looked at the averages of these players in the games that they play. And in some cases, there are certain players that is unfair on, right? Like if you're an Indian player in the 90s, you were playing on flat pitches, but you also had Sachin at the other end. You had, you know, Laxman and Dravid and, you know, all these different players around. So you're batting it. So it makes it look like you weren't as good as you were. And the opposite is true also of some of the West Indian players and the Australian players who the averages are lower in the games they play because their bowlers roll people. So we're trying to go as deep as possible to work out where players should be and why we think that and have a really solid argument for these sorts of players. And, you know, where do we stop with the modern players, right? Like when we started the book, Marnus was actually a very big chance of being in the top 50. And it's like, now he's nowhere near the top 50. So it's like, so we have to be really, really careful with that. And Steve Smith, when I started this book, was probably arguably in the top 3. And he's, I think I'm just having a look at my list over here at the moment. I think we've both got him top 10 at the moment, of the two guys that are working on the book. But no one's got him higher than 8. So it does tell you, you know, modern careers can change. And, you know, if you look at Ricky Ponting retires 3 years earlier, probably has a much, but he probably has a higher ranking in our book. So, and you get the same, one of the key ones is New Zealand players. New Zealand players usually have lower averages because if they show any talent, they're thrust into the team well before they're ready because it doesn't have as deep a talent pool. Whereas an Australian player like Matt Hayden or Adam Gilchrist or Mike Hussey is a really interesting one. Of Mike Hussey, if he started playing at 20, wouldn't be on this list because his batting average wouldn't have been that high. But he might end up close to being in the top 50 because he makes his debut at 28 when he's at his peak batting age. Right. And that's another thing we're looking at. Of there are a lot of players who are absolutely brilliant between the ages of 28 and 32. But that's because most players are brilliant between the ages of 28 and 32. So you're going through and you're making a case for each individual player, for them and against them. And at a certain point, you feel like, you know, you look at Jack Hobbs's record, you start nitpicking and you're like, the man made 197 first class hundreds or 199. We don't know how many he made. We can't even count them. There's arguments about how many he made. And you're nitpicking between him and Sachin Tendulkar, right? And then you've got Len Hutton just behind them. And it does show you just how hard it is. And, you know, when you factor in what greatness is, like, I think you could make a claim that at his absolute best, Brian Lara was a better player than Sachin Tendulkar. And we saw them both play in the same era, right? But Tendulkar was better more often. So is that the thing that you look at? Or do you look at the peaks? Because if you're looking at greatest peaks, maybe Lara is the second greatest batter we have ever had, right? And maybe Tendulkar is like seventh. But if you look at their entire career, does that mean that Tendulkar goes up to number two and Lara goes down to number seven? It's all those sorts of discussions that we're having on a daily basis of, and then we'll find a new nugget or a new story on someone. And there's also the pioneers, you know, players who were, you know, radically different. W.G. Grace, he's a fascinating one of where you fit him in because his batting average in Test cricket is 32, right? And we have players on this list who are averaging 99.94. So how do you have someone averaging 32 in it? But then you go back and you look at in the 1880s, he was already in his 30s, past his best. He was a doctor, so he'd stopped playing cricket full time. And he was 50% better than the other players of his era, right? So you're like, oh, wait a minute. So he has to be in it. But then he plays until he's 51. And when he's in his 40s, you're going to be shocked. He was about the seventh best batter in the world. Still good, but not as dominant, right? So now his numbers slide because he played forever. And you know, you have these conversations. But without W.G. Grace, does Sachin exist? Because W.G. Grace invents forward play and back play. Before that, players either propped on their front foot or propped on their back foot. And it was W.G. Grace who went, that doesn't make any sense. For this ball, I want to be here. And for this ball, I want to be here. And you've got guys like Victor Trumper and Ranji who invented, you know, shots and methods all the way through. And it's like, do we weight them higher because they had a bigger impact on all these cricketers that come behind them? Or do we look for the perfect player? Like, does AB de Villiers go up higher because he had the ability to score at a strike rate of 280 and also to block out a day and a half of a test match? It's just an endless discussion of where these players go. And, you know, so we have rankings for each player at the moment, but we also have ranges. So I'm just having a look. I'm trying to think of there's a couple of really interesting players when it comes to ranges, which is Javed Miandad and Greg Chappell, right? So two players from 70s and 80s when batting was a little bit tougher with really high batting averages. Javed Miandad, everyone thinks he was just a next level genius. And some of the baseball batting that we see today is taken directly from Javed Miandad. Right, he was playing with the crease when no one else was even thinking about that sort of stuff. And Greg Chappell had this beautiful career, but in the middle of it, he went off to play rebel cricket and we didn't even get him in his peak batting years. So we don't even know how good he was. So we've got ranges of them between like 15 and 30. And you could make a really good argument that either of them could be the 15th best batter of all time or the 30th. That's huge, right? And there's lots of players like that. I think Jeffrey Boycott is another one of, we just don't really know where to put Boycott in. And, you know, at one stage we had him really high and now he's really low. As I said before, Matthew Hayden's another one of, you know, if you compare Hayden to other openers, it's like, he has to be really high, but he actually can't be that high because he spent, every time he was struggling, he wasn't in the team. So it's this constant like juggling of all these things. And we haven't even, I've mentioned all these different things. I haven't even mentioned strike rate, right? Like trying to get strike rates for the historical players. We had to go to CricFizz to try and get their database to get to see if there are any outliers that we needed to put on. So there's so much that needs to go in. And it's a constant conversation of, you know, do we weight this higher for this player and weight this lower for this player? Or is it exactly the same? Or, you know, this guy did really well in his era against these teams, but these teams actually weren't that good in his era. So does that mean he should go down? And it's like that all the time.
I guess the big question that a lot of people would want to know, who are the sort of the top batters at the moment that you're sort of continually looking at to try and claim that top spot?
So I don't think there's any players who are playing at the moment who can claim top spot unless because I the book will be finished very, very soon. I think if Steve Smith had another year where he averages, you know, 70 or 80, he could probably go back into that top five position. But I don't think he could break into the top three. Whereas if you'd asked me this, you know, a year and a half ago, I think you could make a very good argument at that point that Steve Smith should have been certainly in the top four. So he's gone down. Virat Kohli had a huge problem with his form. Joe Root, up until this recent series against India, was actually kind of climbing back up our charts quite a bit. And Kane Williamson has made some runs recently, but I don't think that's going to change his spot. So I don't think there's anyone in the modern game who's about to go top five. I mean, it's one of the more ridiculous things that you've ever done because, you know, we're doing you know, the top 50 batters of all time, and yet number one is the most obvious thing. Like, there's just no way of not having Don Bradman at number one. Like, you know, most of these lists, it's like, are they going to pick Jordan or LeBron, or, you know, is it going to be Palais or, you know, Messi, or, you know, which direction are they going to go? And it's like, no, well, it's going to be Bradman, isn't it? I mean, there's no argument that it's going to be Bradman in this. In fact, if World War II hadn't happened, Bradman might actually have a better record. You know, but you know, in modern players, I think, yeah, Smith is certainly the highest. I'm just having a look. And Root is not that far away as well, you know. And I think then you've got Virat and Williamson. I think we've got them ranked in that order at the moment. And that will probably be more or less where they will all stay, just because of where they are in their careers, right? Like, just of and where the book is. Like, I don't think anyone's about to score 700s in a row against a great batting lineup, you know, between now and when the book comes out. That's the kind of thing that we would have to do to change it. But yeah, it's Smith was certainly the highest, and you know, we're only looking at test rankings. If you were factoring in the other formats, you might have Virat ahead of the other guys.
With that mention of Smith there, you mentioned he's towards the top. He's obviously now opening the batting for Australia. How much of a factor would that have to be taken in? If he goes and he absolutely dominates opening the batting, and he's already dominated in the middle order, would that really sort of be as impressive? Because I can't imagine there are many people within the sort of the top of that list who have batted all the way from 8 or 9 all the way up to now opening the batting.
Oh, that's a good question. Let's have a look. Smith would have the most variable. Yeah, Sober's probably batted. I don't think Sober's ever opened. But yeah, I think you're right. I think he would have the biggest jump around the batting order. It is actually quite funny. Look at England, how random their batters were. Like, you know, in a country like Australia, it's like, you're the number three. So this guy just bats number three for like 10 years. Whereas in England, it's like, you're number three. Actually, do you want to open? Later on, do you want to bat number five? So it is, that is something I didn't realize, how much England batters, like, just never played in one position over and over again. But no, you're right. I think if Smith were to open the batting for 2 years in Test cricket with a plus 50 average, I think it would be very hard not to thrust him right back up to the top. I mean, it will probably be the reprint of the book, if we're being honest, not the actual book itself. But it would be very hard not to thrust him all the way back up to the top, I think, at that time, just because that's not normal. But players in their mid-30s, especially players of his talent, do not go, I'm going to start my career as an opener. He's seen mixed results at the moment. I'd say overall people are still quite skeptical about whether it will work, but he did carry his bat and almost steal a test match for Australia in doing so. So it's kind of working and it's not working at the same time. But yeah, if he had a big couple of years, I think he's the one. I don't know if Root, Kohli or Williamson could, I'd be very shocked if any of them would do anything that would change their position massively on our lists at the moment. But Smith is the one who could go from that sort of the back end of the top 10 to the top end of the top 10, which is a pretty big jump. You know, that's going from one of the greatest batters of all time to the GOAT discussion, right? Which is, you know, a big change. You know, then we could say things like, well, Bradman never decided to open, did he?
Very true, exactly. Finally, then, are there any surprises throughout this list, you think? Is there anyone maybe who people either might not have heard of? I mean, maybe some of the older guys that would be, or more likely who people wouldn't consider as a top 50 great batter. But actually, when you look at the stats and how they did in their time compared to others, have really surprised you as much as will the readers when the book comes out.
Do you know what? There's a couple of really interesting ones. There's the one that we are, that will be a major chapter in the book, which is Daryl Cullinan, who is kind of famous because he went out to Shane Warne a lot. And he's like a laughing stock at cricket. And he probably played, of all the great batters we've looked at, he played the era that was the toughest to bat in, right? Like, he never got any easy years of batting. And so if you were to factor that in, he probably doesn't come into the top 50, but you can see straight away of, if it wasn't for the fact he ran into Shane Warne, he's probably on this list. Like, it was one bowler that has probably kept him away, and we all laughed at him. There's also, I think it's Peter May, who's a really fine English player and, you know, very well respected, but I don't think many people would be saying Peter May is like a top 50 batter of all time. But you have a look at Peter May's record and you're like, he might have got the shittest wickets of anyone ever. Like, he must have just, like, test after test. Like, maybe every time England played on a flat wicket, he must have been injured in that game, right? Like, he just didn't get a chance. It's ridiculous how many bad pitches he played on. So he's another really interesting one. There's a guy called Bruce Mitchell, who most cricket fans don't know who Bruce Mitchell is. And he was a South African cricketer in the 30s and 40s who played top order. I think he's got, if I remember correctly, he's got the best fourth innings average of all time, right? Just an absolutely fantastic player. He might end up on this list because his numbers are just so great, but no one talked about South African cricket in that era. It just wasn't particularly, you know, it wasn't particularly talked up. And one of my other favorites is Bob Simpson, the Australian opener, who I can't remember how many tests. I think he went 20, 25 tests without making 100. And his first 100 is a triple, right? And then he, for the next 6 years or 5 years, absolutely dominates everyone he goes up against. And then he retires at 30. So he retires in the middle of his peak batting years and then makes a comeback when he's like 40, right? And in his comeback, he makes runs against, I can't remember if it was India or Pakistan. And then he goes to the West Indies to face the West Indies in their peak. And it's like, everything about Bob Simpson doesn't make any sense at all. So there are some more random cricketers who you wouldn't, you know, instantly put up. And I think there's some really good cricketers who, you know, I don't know if David Warner or Kevin Peterson will make the list, right? And they're both absolutely fantastic players and, you know, have had a big impact on Test cricket. I got Michael Clarke at the moment is quite low on our list. I think he's another one that a few people might have a little bit higher. So there's some players there that don't make as much sense. And, you know, we've still got to factor in how we bring in some of these older players who have phenomenal records. But it, as I said before, it doesn't stack up against modern cricketers in the same way. Like, where does WG Grace actually come in? Being that for one decade, he was by far and away the best player in the world. And we know that was past his prime, because we know his prime. There was a year that... There's a year in county cricket, and it's not just county cricket, all first-class cricket, where WG Grace made more hundreds than everyone else combined. He literally out-batted the entire sport 1 year. But unfortunately, that was about 15 years before Test cricket came around, right? So it's, you know, all those things are really, really fascinating. And so, yeah, I do think that the Cullinans and the Mays and those sort of players are really interesting. But it's also interesting to see sort of where Boycott ends up and, you know, Andy Flower, the Zimbabwean player, and all these sorts of things. And, you know, how do you factor in Virendra Sehwag's strike rate is a really interesting one. So, yeah, I think there'll probably be some, there's not many lists of this on the internet, but I have seen some lists and I think there will be some players on the list that potentially others wouldn't have. But it's not, it's just, we have probably, it's probably the biggest research project I've ever done. And we've gone through the minutiae of so many players. I think I have like, I probably have like 400 to 500 words of notes on each player, but those notes are so dense, and they might be full of like 12 or 15 data points that we have gone through manually. So forget all the algorithmic stuff. I mean, like literally going through a player. So there's all these different players that have all very, very separate kinds of what's the best way of putting it? Like one thing that we wanted to look at is opening batters in South Africa, England, and New Zealand, because that is the hardest place to open the batting. So there's a whole section of looking at openers from that point of view. What is it like to be a top four batter when the opposition sends you in to bat first on day one? We know that's going to be the toughest conditions you ever have to face, right? So little things like that, we are going into detail. And I think our overall list, I'm just having a look now, this doesn't include some of the older guys. So I think our list, our short list is like 95 players, and we have details of all of those players like that. Like Jonathan Trott, no, he's never going to make this list. Sorry, Trotty, if you're listening, but he's never going to make the top 50. But we have like hundreds of words on Jonathan Trott and how his record comes about and everything. So there are, it's a fascinating way of looking at it. And, for me, it's less about what the top 50 ends up being. What I want to be able to explain is sort of the evolution, the origin of batting. And also, we talk so much about great batters and we never say what they are great at, right? And that's what I wanted this book to be, a celebration of, the top 90 batters of all time, right? Of how they did the thing that they did and what makes them all unique or what makes them all the same.
Absolutely. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. And we could go on for hours about just this and hundreds of pages of a book. I'm sure that will be coming out in a few years, hopefully. But Jared, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great chatting to you and hearing your insight on data analytics and also the top 50 best batters of all time.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you all so much for listening, and make sure you head over and follow us on social media. It's pitchside_podcast on Instagram and TobyReynolds10_ on TikTok and Twitter. Make sure you also head over to the Sports Gazette website to read articles from all of our pundits and writers here at the Sports Gazette. Make sure you like the podcast and give it a rating. It really does help. And make sure to join us next time on Pitchside with Toby Reynolds.